From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We hear from you regularly. We always want to hear from you. We're grateful for your support in so many different ways. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday marks the Baha'i Declaration of the Bab, and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins on the evening of May 26th. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
It is high risk. It is high reward. There are a lot of Washington Republicans who are just flat out despondent about how the past week has played out. And they are looking forward to this trip as an opportunity for the president to set the reset button for the zillionth time.
The often less than diplomatic president of the United States has announced that his first foreign trip since the inauguration will include Saudi Arabia, the Vatican, and Israel. We'll get thoughts from Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Jerome Sokolowski.
Wouldn't it be better if at the beginning of every service we just went around and everyone had a chance to say, "Hi, I'm Gene, and I'm here because I'm a sinner. I might enjoy the music, occasionally get a decent sermon. But I'm here because I need to be here."
I was overjoyed this week to learn that the Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson has accepted the position of Vice President, Senior Pastor, and Chair of the President's Advisory Council on Faith in Society at the Chautauqua Institution. As a longtime admirer of both the institution and Bishop Gene, I look forward to discussing this step with him later in the hour. But first,
this fight is not about these monuments, which may hurt some feelings. This fight is essentially a demographic struggle for the future of Western civilization.
Unbelievable. It happened here and it happened now. A torch-bearing, menacing mob marched on Charlottesville, Virginia, some 100 miles from the nation's capital. The troglodyte white nationalists led by alt-right hero Richard Spencer were upset that the city plans to take down the statue of Confederate icon Robert E. Lee. The protest reminded many Southerners of Ku Klux Klan marches from not so long ago, and prompted Mayor Michael Signer to issue a public condemnation. That's when a torrent of anti-Semitic attacks targeting the mayor, who is Jewish, began. And I am so pleased that he has agreed to discuss this ugly episode with us today on our show. Mr. Mayor, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin by you describing briefly the events leading up to the May 13th White Nationalist March on Charlottesville.
We have a couple of statues to Confederate generals in Charlottesville that have been here since the 1920s, and they're right in the vicinity of our downtown mall. About a year ago, there was a protest wanting to move one of the statues, the one to Robert E. Lee. That kind of sparked a whole year of a very eventful controversy in the city. We set up a Blue Ribbon Commission on race memorials and public spaces. And I was very hopeful through this that we could come to a solution that would involve adding rather than subtracting. I rather we create a dynamic in the public spaces where the statue, even if it offends a lot of people, is rebutted and visibly overcome. There was testimony that the Blue Ribbon Commission took on the grounds that if we erase our past, then we will be condemned to repeat it. That was one of their arguments. These should be teachable moments. After that vote was taken to move the statue, this became a cause celeb for the alt-right. And there was a whole other controversy where there was a back and forth between this local alt-right figure and our vice mayor, who's African-American. He started targeting him. So that is the backdrop for what happened on Saturday, where I think this was coincidental, but it was horrible. We have a annual Festival of Cultures where we celebrate the international diversity that we have here in this community, which is a very diverse, wonderful, richly, very progressive community. And he led a protest during this several dozen people in khakis and white shirts, kind of talking about all these alt-right themes. Not only that they wanted white history and Euro-nationalism to be maintained, but that Russia is our friend. This was beyond belief. They were using slogans straight out of the Trump alt-right playbook. And then that night, they showed up again in slightly greater numbers at Lee Park, where the Lee statue is, with tiki torches that apparently they purchased from Walmart, in this display of visual terror and intimidation. And it was disbanded fairly quickly because there was an altercation during it where somebody started confronting them and then they confronted that person. But the images literally went around the world. And I put out a statement saying that intolerance is not welcome in the city and saying that it harkened to the days of the KKK. And I think that was what got a lot of people's attention, and I stand by that. And then that led me to become the target of a wave of attacks also from a lot of this quarter. And so it's been just a really crazy week.
I'm sure it has. What was the effect on you personally, and especially with the festival going on, what was the effect of the people in Charlottesville?
Well, very ironically, the organizers of the Festival of Cultures had just the prior week gone through what's called bystander training for if there were people trying to harass them, how would they address it? So let me put a little bit of context on this. We have a major office, the International Rescue Committee here, which brings hundreds of political refugees to Charlottesville. And these are people who fled tyranny in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Iran. The point of bystander training is you're taught how to deal with somebody coming to disrupt your event. And one of the key parts of it that you do is you focus on the victim, not on the harasser. So you're trying to calm things down, secure the situation, ease the pain of somebody who's being targeted, and diffuse things rather than playing into the heckler or the harasser who has shown up to make the event about them and their grievance. So they had just been through that, and that was effective. It was taken in stride, and that they were seen as marginal figures. So it did not have nearly the sensational effect that the event at night did. That really was scary, I think, for people, for us to become the venue for this act that was out of 50 years ago and or 100 years ago. And it was very alarming for this community. And it has led to a lot of solidarity and a lot of compassion here and a lot of anger.
You know, Mayor Signer, I don't think we would have expected anything like this just a couple of years ago, and now it's somehow less surprising. Is this part of the new normal, do you think?
I fear so. I think that the Trump campaign and Breitbart News and forces that swirl around to create this new alt-right movement have blessed a different kind of politics and have ratified practices and actions that were beyond the pale just like 3 years ago. And I think that it runs the gamut, that it has become okay for people to talk publicly about white nationalist ideas in a way that seems like it's part of our regular discourse, is connected to the messaging that we saw all last year and to what is happening online in these communities. I think it's also connected to this wave of of anti-Semitic attacks that I've seen in the last week, which have really, that's been a new experience for me. I'd never seen that before. And it, and the level, the just the level, well, I mean, some of them are just historical tropes, you know, that, that I thought had been retired after World War II. And then some of them are much more kind of disturbing mashups of ideas from politics today, just mixed up with regular anti-Semitism. But I think all that is fairly new in our politics. And I do think it's all connected. I'm an optimist about all this in a strange way. I think that the resistance movement that we're having, that we're experiencing, is probably one of the most exciting constitutional moments in the country's history. It's happening because of that other stuff, and it's very painful to watch, but for every step backward, we're going to take a large step forward. That's been the country's history, but it's a wild ride when you're in public life.
I bet. Well, you literally have written the book on demagogues,
right.
And
yeah.
Is it playing out just as you described it in your book?
Yeah, so I wrote a book in 2009 called Demagogue, The Fight to Save Democracy from Its Worst Enemies, and it is on a number of levels. One of the things in that book was I was interested in periods when democracy are tested and when they come under stress, the way they react to this demagogue threat. So we have thought about demagogues since the very beginning of our founding, and demagogues are all over the Federalist Papers. And the first and the last Federalist Paper, the Founding Fathers are very worried about demagogues erupting in the country. And they were sprinkled throughout the Constitutional Convention, the writing of the Constitution, the Electoral College, the way the Senate was designed. There's institutions that are about trying to avoid these sort of predatory mass leaders who would prey on our passions and our prejudices. In the 1930s, when demagogues were erupting in Europe, of course, Hitler and Mussolini, this country went through a very intense period of self-examination and of reflection, of activism about demagogues here. So that was when you had Huey Long and Father Coughlin. And then you had a really new level of executive authority with FDR having four terms in the presidency, which also led to a lot of concern and vigilance about democracy itself. You could call that resistance another kind of resistance. So when he tried to pack the Supreme Court, that led to a backlash from the American people, and he wasn't able to get that done in Congress. And you also had hyper vigilance about Huey Long and Father Coughlin and a number of other figures like them in that period when we were seeing it happen in Europe. So I think what's happening right now with Trump and this resistance movement is another chapter like that. It was just like we had anti-racist chapters when racist demagogues in the South were rebutted by waves of civil rights activism. It's a similar thing to anti-McCarthyism when Joseph McCarthy led people to challenge that introduction of fear-mongering and demagoguery. And we are always taking one step backward and a step forward with a great deal of stress and a lot of struggle by the people involved in politics and policy. And that, I think, is exactly what's happening now.
You said you are optimistic. Where do you get your hope in a moment like this when you're surrounded by the level of anger and hatred that you've seen?
I think the arc of history when it comes to democracy and to human enlightenment is progressive. I just do. Mm-hmm. I think there's much more evidence in favor of that idea than on the other hand of it. And I think that it's tested brutally. I mean, the biggest test was last century during World War II, obviously, and that led to tens of millions of people dying, and to the, you know, the Jewish race being the subject of an attempt at extinguishing them. But the last decades have seen a very sound overcoming and a repudiation of every one of those ideas and attempts. So we're seeing, I think, from these terrorist elements, this new virus along those lines, also an attack on human enlightenment, but I think we are going to defeat that. And I think it's because enlightenment is more powerful than the forces that try to kill it. But it's a stress and a strain and a struggle and a back and forth dialectical process to achieve higher rungs on the ladder of history. And I think that it's been a very, very difficult challenge for me to put this in perspective. So I enjoy doing interviews like this because it's a chance to get deeper into the foundation of this. And there was a lot of media attention earlier this week. The New York Times, I wasn't even aware they had done an editorial yesterday about what happened here in Little Charlottesville with this rally on Saturday. But on the other hand, we got to keep this in perspective because these were clowns who had bought tiki torches at Walmart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they are parroting completely incoherent cliches that were soundly rejected decades and decades ago. And I don't think they have a large base for anti-Semitic attacks or for white nationalist policies or for being against pluralism and diversity in our society. They're not going to get anywhere on those. Like, look what's happening in our country. We are becoming a majority-minority. Employers do care about diversity. Gay marriage is legal here. We are opening our borders. The Muslim ban was defeated. This is not where the country is going. They're furious about that. It's retrograde stuff, and they're trying to force it into public view, but it is being rejected, and it will be rejected. We will be in a better place in 25 years from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, in terms of enlightenment ideas about human progress and the progress of our democracy. We just will. So I have that confidence. I just think we are always tested in a free democracy, and the challenge is how do we rise to the occasion, and that's why this resistance movement was so important. This election of Donald Trump was, I think, the summa of the tests that this democracy in our lifetime is going to be presented with. You know, you could say there's honest demagoguery, which is just somebody who ordinarily plays to somebody's fears and prejudices. And the question is, do they have defenses for that? And does society rise to the challenge to rebut the demagogue and defuse them? That's one part. And then there's dishonest demagoguery, which is when you have a foreign power trying to rig and manipulate an actual media and an election system. And you really saw a perfect storm of both of those in this last year. I think we are rising to the system. The courts are rising to the challenge. And our media certainly is, and our people are, and now you're seeing maybe even the Senate and the House will, and certainly the Department of Justice, and that's good news. That's good news.
It just has
been a hell of a scary ride getting here.
Michael Signer is the mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia. Mayor Signer, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you giving us this time and to hear your perspective on hope when some people haven't quite found it yet. So,
but they got to keep fighting.
They got to keep fighting.
Yeah. So this is an active hope. This is not like, oh, I can sit back and hope will be validated. I have to participate. You have to be part of it to make the hope real. That is the key. There need to be millions of people involved in making this hope real.
Well, thanks so much for making the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
The Chautauqua Institution was founded in 1874 in western New York State. While it's offered a broad range of retreat, academic, and entertainment experiences for many decades, the institution began with a focus on and continues to offer religion-themed programming. I've had the honor of participating in many of the programming events over the years, and I hold the institution in very high regard. That's why it was no surprise when the announcement came this week that Chautauqua is bringing on the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, to head up its religion programming. I was so pleased. Bishop Gene is a hero for many of us. Thanks to his lifetime of work on faithful inclusivity, and I'm delighted to have him back with us on State of Belief Radio. Gene, congratulations and welcome back to the show.
Well, Walton, it's always great to be here with you, and I guess especially right now because it's pretty exciting for me. For an old guy, you know, apparently you can teach an old dog new tricks.
That's right. Well, what drew you to this new challenge? What made you want to work with the Chautauqua Institution?
You know, for the last couple of years now, I have been a senior fellow amongst about 15 other senior fellows at Auburn Seminary in New York City. And it's an interfaith group. You know, we have a Buddhist clergy person, we have a Sikh, a Muslim woman, two rabbis, and a variety of Christians. And I have just become increasingly convinced that interfaith is the future of religion. Because I think what we see right now in culture is that there is less difference between various people of various faiths than there is between people of faith and people of no faith. And I think we're finally at a point, and you've been doing this for years, but I think we're finally at a point to begin to understand that there is room in our understanding of God for all kinds of expressions of faith. And Chautauqua is absolutely committed to moving in this interfaith direction, and I think it will make Chautauqua stronger. Maureen Rubenio has already been doing a lot of this work, and we will take it even further together.
Well, talk about what your role is at Chautauqua and also what the role of Chautauqua is in addressing today's issues of religion.
So there are several pieces to my job. One is to hopefully be a wise counsel to the president, particularly in matters of religion. It is to work with Maureen Rubenio, who is now being promoted to Director of Religion, and together to select and invite preachers of the week, as well as those who will deliver the main religion lecture each day at 2 o'clock. Another part of my job is as senior pastor, and this is really a small village, a village that comes together in a very dramatic way for 9 weeks in the summer. And as with any village, as with any community of people, there are always pastoral needs. And I'm delighted to get back to that. You know, I consider myself a person with a pastor's heart. And so getting to do that a little more intentionally now and to be doing it again is great. The last thing is very exciting. The new president, Michael Hill, who has just got such an amazing vision for Chautauqua's future, wants me to sort of design, put together, and recruit a special President's Advisory Council on Faith in Society. And that will be made up of some of the top leaders in the various Christian denominations, as well as representatives of all the world's faiths. And together with the president, we will be trying to envision and lay out the trajectory for religion for Chautauqua for the next 10 to 20 years. And I think we're going to be able to assemble an amazing group of people.
Well, for many Americans, it seems like the political religious right is reaping immense rewards for helping elect Donald Trump. How do you see that?
It was maybe the most shocking result of the election, besides the election of Donald Trump, the fact that I think the number was 81% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump, and even a majority of women. I think it maybe gives us the notion that religion isn't all that important to this group that we thought religion was everything, that indeed politics for them may indeed trump, if you'll pardon the expression, their religion. Yeah. I mean, this is a man thrice married who arguably is one of the most profane, vulgar, hate-filled public figures today. The fact that he could be elected president is just shocking to me. Here's the one thing I will say, however. Not all of them, but there's a good chunk of people who voted for Donald Trump who genuinely are in pain. And they are in pain because they believe they have been left behind in all kinds of ways by this culture, and that the culture has a condescending attitude and a very judgmental attitude towards them. I, in my own personal opinion, I think they chose the wrong solution to that pain, which was Donald Trump. But I think the rest of us need to take very seriously the pain, because unless we are able to speak to it and to do something about it, then I think, you know, the next election will be just as terrible as this one was, in my opinion.
I'm interested, do you continue to find inspiration in the way many progressive people of faith have been coming together to defend American values since the inauguration?
The people who are stepping forward and saying, this is not who we are, is one of the most encouraging developments out of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, let's remember, at least for Christians, this takes us back to our roots. Because for the first 300 years following the life of Christ, we were the culture, the society's gadfly. We were the group that critiqued the secular power. And perhaps fortunately, when Constantine was converted to Christianity, and Christianity became the religion of the empire, we crawled in bed with power. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, power corrupts, right?
That's right.
And so in some sense, I think the Christian faith has sold at least a bit of its soul to be in good with the powers that be. And this is an opportunity for us to reclaim that perspective that we used to have, that it is the role of religion to morally critique what is going on. No matter who is in power, be it Democrat, Republican, or whatever, the church ought to be offering a critique of the values being lived out as a country. Yep. And so I certainly find that newly revitalized prospect very, very exciting.
Gene, what concerns you most about the current level of controversy in Washington?
I think the first thing that alarms me is that we're getting used to this, and I think that is the greatest danger of all, that somehow this will become the new normal. And I am praying daily that that not be the case. The second thing that strikes me is that we have at least a president, possibly an administration, that seems committed to not being bound by the truth or by facts. And that's a very dangerous place to be, because if you're not listening to the truth, if you're not seeing the facts as they are presented, then it means we're cut loose from every possible bearing we might have. And it's just every man, woman, and child for themselves. And that's not a very comforting vision of what America should be. And so I think it's possible for us to critique this administration, but just to critique the entire process, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we should be saying to the Congress, we're better than this. Get in there and do the right thing. I mean, I get that we're very politically polarized, but it seems to me that some of what we have seen here goes far beyond what either party should consider to be acceptable behavior, certainly in a president.
Gene, I know that I'm not alone in gaining reassurance simply by listening to your voice. You never fail to inspire, and I can never resist asking you some question about that. And there are a lot of people in our nation who are hurting for various reasons. Where do you draw hope from at a challenging time like this?
You know, at the very center of the communion service are the words, "Do this in remembrance of me." And the Greek word that gets translated in remembrance of is the word anamnesis. And if you pull that apart into its two parts, the A-N that begins the word means an or anti or the opposite of. And then the second part of the word, amnesis, is where we get amnesia. right? Mm-hmm. So anamnesis is being against amnesia and gets translated in our liturgy as do this in remembrance of me. And I think that's something to pay attention to right now that should give us hope. We have to keep remembering who we are and what our values are. And despite our inability to live into them fully, what the values are stated in our Constitution. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether you're a person of faith or not, those values are our shared communal values. And I think it's just important to remember that we've been through trying times before. I mean, it was not all that long ago that we were locking Japanese and Chinese people up in internment camps, right? And we have been through xenophobic times before. For way too long in our history, we were enslaving an entire people. We have strayed far from those values before, and the kind of miracle of America is that somehow, if we remember those values, we can find our way back. And I believe we will. Do I think it will be easy? No, I do not. And do I think we're going to have to talk to a lot of people that we'd frankly rather not talk to? Mm-hmm. Yes, we're going to have to do that. But in remembering who we are, it seems to me that we can come home again. And for me, my own faith, which is always about resurrection rather than crucifixion, keeps me going in the secular discussion that we're having about who we are as a country. So, oddly enough, as terrible as I think things are at the moment, I'm always hopeful.
The Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson starts in his new position as Vice President, Senior Pastor, and Chair of the President's Advisory Council on Faith in Society at the Chautauqua Institution this September. Bishop Gene was the first openly gay man to be consecrated a bishop in the Episcopal Church and led the Diocese of New Hampshire until his retirement in 2013. His compelling stories told in the film Love, Free, or Die, and he's the author of several invaluable books, including God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage, and In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God. Gene, I don't hesitate to say we'll all be better for you taking this position at this time. Thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
It is always a pleasure to be with you, and you should stand forewarned. I'm going to get you to Chautauqua because you need to be a part of this conversation that we are going to have, not just about the future of Chautauqua, but the interfaith future for all of us.
I would be honored to be a part of that and enjoy it as well. With the president's first overseas trip underway, I wanted to talk with Jerome Sokolowski, editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, about this trip and the challenges of religious journalism in the age of Trump. Jerome, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Good to be with you, Welton.
Let me stipulate that we're talking on Thursday, and by the time this airs, the president's trip will have started. Now, with that in mind, what has the most potential to make news on this trip, Jerome?
Well, Welton, I think you're right to have the caveat, because with this presidency, we never really know what to expect. I think we in the news business need to brace ourselves for anything that could possibly happen. Now, looking ahead at this trip, and, you know, again, I may be completely wrong this weekend or completely off based on what's actually happened, but a lot of people have been characterizing this trip as a tour of monotheistic capitals, with the president going to Saudi Arabia, going to Israel, going to Rome. In Israel, he's reportedly going to stop at the Western Wall, the Jewish holy site. You know, we have to be careful not overstating the religious component, even going to Rome and to meet the Pope. you know, a much anticipated meeting, given the things that the Pope and candidate Trump said to each other or about each other during the campaign. But at the same time, these are very political destinations, especially Saudi Arabia. Unlike in Roman Catholicism, the Saudis do not head kind of a world Islam. They are custodians of Muslim holy sites, but as monarchs, they don't have any real authority over Muslims around the world. It's complex, and obviously we're paying a lot of attention to it, but with the caveats, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, when we talk about Israel, think of Holy Land. It is that for many people. But when President Trump gets to Israel, he's not there to talk about the Holy Land and to see holy sites. He's there to deal with Israeli politics and how we get together. And I hope a conversation about how we trade security information. What do you expect from the Israel part of this trip?
You know, I think a lot of this trip will be photo opportunities for the president. That'll be the case to a certain extent in Saudi Arabia, definitely in Rome with the Pope, and then certainly in Israel being photographed at the Western Wall with the Israeli Prime Minister. As far as anything tangible, will it move anything in the Israeli-Palestinian dialogue? I can't say. I mean, certainly one thing that candidate Trump promised was to move the Israeli embassy to Jerusalem. And pretty quickly after he became president, he backpedaled on that pledge. There were realities in the Middle East that he didn't have to think about when he was a candidate that he did have to think about as president that made him change his mind in that respect. So he's been promising to move the peace process forward in a way that no other president has been able to. The question is, you know, what are the realities there too? So I don't expect too much, I have to say, in that respect.
Well, Jerome, you know, the president's just appointed Calista Gingrich as ambassador to the Vatican. Trump's going to be meeting with the Pope next week. What are your thoughts about that meeting?
Well, I think when a Pope meets a U.S. president, they shake hands. Who knows what they say to each other in private? There's no real serious policy issues to be negotiated with a Pope. The Pope certainly has his views on economics, on global poverty, climate change, areas where he has a very, very different view than our president. I don't even know if he needs to talk about it during the meeting for the president to know where he stands. I don't think the meeting will change anything. It's not going to change a papal encyclical or anything that's come out so far from the Pope. So again, I think, you know, mainly we're seeing a photo opportunity. Mm-hmm. Now, Trump being Trump, he may say something after the meeting that makes all of us laugh, cringe, I don't know what.
Talk a minute, if you would, about the biggest challenges of covering religion news in this new American paradigm.
That's a great question, Welton. And I think at a certain point, pretty soon after the election, we made a conscious decision not to run after every tweet or every utterance from the president. And a lot of it does touch on religion and religious belief and religious communities, especially if you think about the travel ban, but also other areas with abortion and certain elements of the Affordable Care Act and the plan to repeal and replace that. We felt that there's so much more to religion in America than the politics of it, even though there's been so much attention to the politics of it right now. Mm-hmm. There's certainly very interesting stories like the fragmentation of evangelicals over this president, the dispute within the Southern Baptist Convention over how Russell Moore, one of their ethics spokesmen, mm-hmm. Russell Moore has dealt with it and the blowback he got from within his ranks over that. However, we felt that there's a lot more to explore in American religion right now than just how it relates to Donald Trump. It's been a challenge, but I think we've been pretty successful at that.
I'm curious as to how you make decisions on that, because I know it comes at you in bags full of stuff that you could do. How do you narrow that down and do something that addresses religion in a little bit of a distinctive way?
Well, I guess we're fortunate in that we try to look at all issues from the perspective of, is it an RNS story? Is there a religion component here? So we don't have to be the first to break a story. We're not an AP or Reuters. We see ourselves as a kind of AP or news agency of religion news, but we're a small outfit. We can't just be on top of every single story, every little thing that happens. Mm-hmm. So we always try to take a step back and say, okay, where can we go with this story that someone else hasn't? Or what angle can we take on this story that others haven't? So the story needs to have a certain resonance or dimension that works for us. Mm-hmm. One thing we did do around the time of the inauguration is look at people who believe that God is at work in American politics today, and that Donald Trump's election was actually something that was divinely ordained, if you will, that God's hand was in the election. We actually even called it the Hand of God series. We profiled people who think that's the case. One of the people we profiled thought God's hand was actually a Trump opponent, but he thought God's hand was in this election as a challenge to us.
What do you see as the most important threads to follow in the weeks and months ahead for anyone that's concerned about the role of religion in American politics and vice versa?
Well, I mean, given what's happening now and the fact that impeachment is not an altogether far-fetched notion right now, we have to ask ourselves what will happen if Trump is impeached and forced out of office. We'll have Mike Pence as president. Mm-hmm. And I think there, given his connections to the Christian right, there certainly will be more of a religious dimension to the presidency than there is now, and carrying out a very conservative agenda. So that's something we would look forward to. If Trump stays in office, I think it will be quite different. And I think his most recent executive order on religious liberty is a bit of an indication of how he's not quite delivering on the things he promised to religious conservatives.
I'm just going to say, I think the president himself stepped back for some reason from where he was going, which was very frightening to me. I'm not sure that if the vice president moved up to the presidency, that he wouldn't stay right on a very hard line about that.
I think you're right. I think to a certain extent, there was realization in the administration that certain things that Trump promised, he just can't deliver by himself, like repealing the Johnson Amendments, the law that prohibits politics from the pulpit for a tax-exempt organization, a tax-exempt church, that he can't just repeal that. He can advise the Justice Department to be selective or to not pursue those cases as aggressively, but he can't just repeal it. So partly it's the realities, and I think partly he's not really a religious conservative. I think he played to that or pandered to that constituency to become elected, and now he's doing whatever he thinks is best to stay in office.
Yeah. Talk for a minute about the RNS event that's happening on Monday. The Cyber Attacks and the Just War Theory is a panel discussion at the National Press Club in Washington. What can you tell us about that?
That's a panel that's being organized by our new publisher, Tom Gallagher. He's been organizing a number of events, getting very thoughtful people together to discuss current events, relevant issues. And I think given what's been happening with cyber espionage and all that, this is a very, very relevant panel. There will be some interesting panelists. One of them is a Father Brian Hare. He's a Jesuit, very deep thinker, very interesting and very thoughtful and insightful man.
Jerome Sokolowski is a longtime journalist with deep experience in religious news and both at home and abroad. Since 2015, Jerome is the very busy editor-in-chief of Religion News Service. I urge you to follow their invaluable non-denominational coverage at religionnews.com. Jerome, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Appreciate you taking time to do that again. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Likewise, Welton. I always love being on your show, and I love the questions you ask. Keep doing what you're doing.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. Your support is essential in keeping this show on the air. And these conversations are available online. For over 11 years now, we have worked incredibly hard to make sure this show is one you can trust and rely on. At a time when so much of what each of us reads, hears, and watches is subject to doubt, your trust is priceless to us. We will not let you down. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing what you heard. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.